It's a beautiful morning.
Good morning, Barcelona. Welcome to Thursday in English Radio on RKB 106.9 FM. I'm Virgil, still and always. Yesterday, September 11th, or La Diada, as is known here in Catalonia, commemorates our defeat in the War of Spanish Succession in 1714, but more importantly, it was a day to celebrate the defense of the rights and freedoms of Catalonia. So join us today to talk about really where we are in this fight for those rights and freedoms. Our two friends, former guests, and members of the ANC, Jordi Villanova and Mikhail Strubel. Welcome,
great
guys.
Great to be back. Thanks for having us.
That's right. I agree.
Well, you know, it's been almost 2 years now since the referendum of 1 October 2017. What's the status of the movement for Catalan independence today?
There's a lot of disappointment, obviously, because there was great expectations coming from the 1st of October, a referendum where everybody who wanted to was very much involved in defending the places, the voting places, the work that had gone into this. We're talking about people, volunteers, plain citizens who had become very much involved in organizing all this. It wasn't directly the government at all. So I think that there's a great deal of disappointment, and even people probably feel a bit depressed as well, maybe.
Mm, yeah.
So we've seen that in the comments. I've heard on TV and on the radio, people being interviewed at the demonstration itself. But let's face it, I mean, you know, we're talking about 600,000 people out on the streets.
And we're talking about yesterday, we had the gathering at the Plaza España and the various streets surrounding it, and whatever the number is, and we were talking about that earlier, it doesn't matter, it's a hell of a lot of people who are saying, yes, we believe in the concept of independence.
Most definitely. I mean, I think the playing around with numbers is really irrelevant. When you just look anywhere in Western Europe, you won't find this scale of people turning out to demonstrate on a holiday in the afternoon. A lot of them having spent hours on, you know, in coaches or on the train or in cars. And in full agreement in the end on the same objective that has been prominent in the Catalan political movement for 10 years now, probably.
Not forget that this is every year.
Right.
Okay, numbers have dropped a bit, or maybe even considerably in the opinion of many. And it's true, but I mean, this is every single year.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Well, I think, you know, there's a lot that we're going to talk about. We'll be back to talk with you guys right after this.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got a bad feeling.
That was Keb Mo with "The Worst Is Yet to Come." Obviously, that is kind of a lead into this segment we're talking about. And again, it could be argued that we haven't seen the worst here, either with some of our elected leaders taking sanctuary outside of Spain, others on trial for sedition, the control of the Catalan government not totally in our hands. What's your take on it all? Where are we going?
Well, you know, to summarize the issue in less than 3 hours is probably rather difficult. The worst may yet to become to come. Just looking at the Supreme Court trial, I mean, it's obvious there was no evidence to find the defendants guilty. I think
or to be arrested.
Well, or even to be arrested and certainly put on trial. So the worst may still to become because it may be that they're not acquitted. I'm a firm believer in justice in general, and I'm trying to avoid or close my ears to many, many, many opinions saying that this is going to be an extremely tough verdict with very long jail sentences to try and decapitate and cleanse Catalan society of its independence movement.
I mean, you hit the nail on the head there, because I think that's what they want to do. And I think we've fallen into their trap. In other words, we've focused everything on the trial. Our leaders are in jail or out of the country, in exile. But we have to start considering that we need to find new leaders, new leadership. Obviously, Omnium has a good leader. I feel that Assemblea has a good leader. The parties need to decide who is going to take over the leadership. I mean, we can't have leadership from prison or from Geneva. Seriously.
Yeah. I mean, when we look at the thing here in terms of the seats in the legislature that we need to have in terms of majority. I mean, you've got, COOP has a very small share. The ERC has a fairly big share. The CS has, big share. Junts for Catalonia has, also a good share, but nobody has enough of a minority. So we're going to have a coalition. When the coalition says, well, you're going to have to give up power. and be able to share power. And again, from a political standpoint, and you're just, you know, knowing my time in the U.S., you know, it's difficult for a politician to share power.
Don't forget that there is a coalition in government right now. There's Junts per Catalunya with Esquerra. The presidency is held by Junts per Catalunya President Torra. The vice presidency is held by Pere Aragonès, who is an ERC leader. So the coalition's already there. And there must be an understanding. I mean, what I'm saying is that there is an understanding. In other words, if Esquerra, who has seen their majority in votes, both in local elections, in the autonomous elections, and although not in the European elections, okay, very recently had a clear majority, all the polls say that they're likely to win, they could have had the government fall. They could have withdrawn from the government, used their votes within the Catalan parliament, and just let the government fall. And that would have meant elections, which they obviously would have won, or at least all the indicators say they would have won. Okay, but they didn't do that. So there's obviously an understanding between Junts per Catalunya and Esquerra. They're not clear on the strategy to go forward, but they are speaking. And we must not forget that.
Well, the thing is, you know, that, you know, looking at some of the numbers from, you know, 1 October, that referendum, you know, 90% of the voters, you know, opted for independence. But actually, the turnout really represented only 43% of the total registered voters. So again, you know, we look at it, and again, look at the U.S. in terms of our last election. Are we really looking at a true expression of what the Catalan people want, or really looking at that of a sector of a quote-unquote extreme group of separatists?
You don't have 2 million people being regarded as extremists, well, no, by no. definition. Having said that, I come back to what Jordi just said before. If you look at what proportion of the electorate votes for the winner in general elections. Go back to the sweeping majority that PP got in 2011, for instance.
Right.
They got 32, just under 32% of the electoral census. So that was a massive victory. They got well over half of the seats in Parliament. Wonderful. That's 32%.
Of the total registered voters.
Okay. Well, we're talking here on the 1st of October, not of 32, but of 39%. So let's say the victory in terms of the yes vote was far greater than in an ordinary general election. And being, you'd have had to have a turnout of double that, which is extremely high, and everyone else voting no for that the result to be overturned, let's say.
Okay. An example of that is the Brexit referendum, which is, nobody ever says this, but of the registered voters in the UK and abroad who had the right to vote, 37% voted to leave. 37%.
Great.
That was due to abstention. Now, probably there would be less abstention here, or maybe there would be a considerable amount of abstention, but the abstention is there. So, I mean, we can't believe that the electoral results would be reflected in the same way in a referendum.
Well, I think, you know, again, we kind of alluded to it earlier before we came on. You know, yesterday we saw, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, you know, commemorating history and hoping for a better future. How do we maintain that hope? How do we translate, you know, hope into action of some kind?
Well, as I was saying, I mean, I think that the major parties in government, in the coalition government, are speaking. Well, we know they're speaking because they're having meetings in Geneva. Okay, so Puigdemont recently joined Marta Rovira, who's the Secretary General of Esquerra, in Geneva to make a video getting people to turn out yesterday. They are discussing. They are in discussions.
But how does that translate to something for the man on the street? You know, we used to say, you know, in the States, people vote with their pockets, you know, in terms of look to see what is going to help my, you know, income, my salary, my pension, whatever, my job prospects. You know, how do we take those political actions, those meetings, those discussions, and make it meaningful for the guy on the street to say, okay, I see something that's going to work?
I was asked this by a taxi driver a couple of years ago, and I said, obviously the future is, you know, extremely vague. You can't define it clearly. But what I did say was that laws on limiting housing evictions, for instance, or laws on reducing energy poverty, or laws on environmental protection, or banning bullfights, or even raising funds from bank accounts. Well, all of this was challenged by the Spanish government. Mm. These are Catalan laws, which obviously, had they not been challenged, would be in effect. So that there are clear, let's say, objective reasons to believe that independence would improve the lot of the ordinary people and give us a hope of surviving in an increasingly hostile physical environment.
And that's from the point of view of the pocket, but going forward as well, I believe that the sooner the parties and the civic grassroots organizations start telling us what they're thinking of doing, the better.
Absolutely. I go along with that totally, because, again, going back to my time in Chicago politics, it came down to the precinct captain level. The guy who's out there on the streets mobilizing people to come out and vote, you know, it's a matter of saying, okay, this is what you can expect to get. This is what the party is all about. So we'll be back to talk some more, you know, right after this.
Fair.
Rosituana with You Can't Always Get What You Want. Well, we haven't been able to secure independence, but what can we expect to get? What do we want to get?
Well,
that's two separate questions.
Yeah,
that's true.
Let's see. I think we need to look at what the situation is right now, analyze it just a little bit. So you've got this caretaker government in Barcelona, in Madrid.
Right. Okay.
They're refusing to negotiate with their potential allies and partners in government. They're just refusing point blank. Mm-hmm. It very much looks like they want to go to new elections, to fresh elections. Because, I mean, otherwise they would have come to an agreement by now. I mean, they've had weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks to come to some kind of arrangement with Podemos.
Yeah, but that brings up the question of, you know, again, we talk about power. What are they gaining by not negotiating? What are they protecting by not negotiating?
They want fresh elections where they believe they'll get an absolute majority, a sufficient majority, so they don't have to. They can, you know, they can have a clear path to governance for themselves. And then here locally, the Catalan government is still under the in fact under 155, Article 155 of the Constitution,
right.
Where the budget has been frozen. Okay, the Spanish government refuses to pay up arrears and the compensation that they need to pay. While taxes are being collected, okay, before the new year comes round, so the Catalan government has not been able to set their budget. Also, because the opposition here refuses to negotiate, now finally they're negotiating for the 2019 budget. Okay, yeah, okay, to close the 2019 budget for the following budget. Okay. So it doesn't have, so it won't roll over into yet another year.
Right.
Okay. But the Spanish government is refusing to pay up arrears, etc. And in the meantime, you've got the half the government in prison and the other half. So there's a kind of caretaker government here as well.
Right.
And as I mentioned before, there's no new leadership. Okay, so that's the analysis of the situation right now. So it's really, really complicated, not just for Catalonia, but also for Spain as well, because of Catalonia, obviously, because one of the reasons that the PSOE refuses to come to an agreement with Podemos, very likely why they don't want them in a coalition government, is not because of their economic policies or anything like that. It's because of the Catalan issue, because the Podemos agrees with the right to decide, in other words, self-determination, the right to have a referendum.
Well, I think, you know, I'm glad you talked about, you know, financial aspects, because again, Catalonia represents 19% of Spain's GDP. We generate, you know, almost 26% of Spain's exports, and we're getting 21% of the foreign investment, and we only represent 16% of the total population. So it doesn't seem like we're doing badly, but again, you know, we have financial power. You know, where is our leverage? You know, how do we, you know, force these guys in Madrid to, you know, come to the table?
We don't have financial power. We may have economic power, which is obviously related, but not the same thing. If you look at Catalonia, you can see it's creating wealth as a rich region, but its public services are those of a poor region.
Okay.
And that means that to fund the essential services, the Catalan authorities have been forced to build up what is an untenable, unsustainable debt, while the huge middle class in Catalonia, in the main, has had to pay for private health schemes, toll motorways, everyone pays tolls, semi-private schools and so on, and massive queues at Barcelona airport in the summer because Madrid is understaffing the airports it runs.
I don't believe, though, that the debt is that bad. Okay, if you look at the Catalan administration's debt with respect to the GDP, I mean, these are figures from the Bank of Spain I'm going to give you now, okay? First quarter 2019, public debt, 33.9%. Okay, so it's one-third of the productivity or production of the whole economy in Catalonia is in under public debt. Okay, it sounds really bad, doesn't it? Okay. Let's compare that. Let's compare that with Spain's 97.1% public, public debt. Let's compare that with the UK's 86.9%. Let's compare that with Germany. Germany, like, you know, really wealthy, 60.9% of GDP in public debt. And Sweden, which is like really balanced, well, that's, you know, 38.8%. Still more than Catalonia's 33.9. Actually, the first quarter of 2019 is down just one-tenth from 34% last year.
So it's basically you're saying that our economic revenues generated are really more than balancing off the public debt.
It means that if Catalonia became independent tomorrow, it would only have to work on, you know, 33.9% of public debt. That's not counting private debt, obviously,
right?
Which I don't have figures for, but it can't be much worse than Spain or anywhere in southern Europe.
But the drainage of public money out of Catalonia every year is equivalent to about 8% of Catalonia's GDP. You know, so I mean, just 4 years of not having that outflow would, in fact, liquidate completely what would be the sovereign debt.
Yeah, well, I think the country should have public debt. In other words, if you're going to have decent social services, education, health, all sorts of services, I mean, you know, the interest is really low right now. So, I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with having debt.
And that's the role of government.
Right, exactly.
The role of government is to finance those things that the people need.
So potentially, Catalonia, an independent Catalonia, would be perfectly able to finance itself. As Miquel says, I mean, you know, 8% is drained out towards Spain. Okay, let's see. Let's go into negotiations with Spain. Maybe we could take on part of the debt for them, okay, in return for, you know, whatever we come to an agreement with. But the problem is that they refuse to negotiate anything.
They are the true unilaterals. They refuse to sit down. Catalans are well known for being pactistas, getting around the table like good shopkeepers and thrashing out solutions. Let's say, at least traditionally, Spaniards have not had that image, let's say, and I fear that the leadership in Spain has carried on that idea of, you know, divide and conquer, and particularly conquer.
Yeah, I mean, look at Catalan governments. They've always been coalitions. Obviously, the longest coalition was between Convergencia and Unió, and that practically became one single party, practically. But it was two parties. It was two parties. It was a coalition for 30-odd years, okay? There's always been coalitions here in Catalonia, okay? In Madrid, the Madrid government has never, ever had a coalition. They're totally unused to it.
Well, to me, I kind of liken it back, you know, the history. If we look at the history of Catalonia, even before Catalonia was not a part of Spain, when Catalonia was Catalonia, it was always a nation looking out. It was a great trading company. We financed, you know, the world and many things. We helped build businesses. You know, we encouraged trade. Mm-hmm. So it was always a case where we were looking at being able to sit at the table and come to an agreement, be able to listen to opinions, you know, get the best bargain for what we're doing. And obviously we financed, you know, many of Spain's wars and all the rest of it. So, but it's a case where, you know, you think, and again, being a business guy, you think, hey, you got this guy who's contributing this much to our well-being. You sit down and talk. it's just good business.
We want to play soccer, but they insist on playing, you know, wrestling or boxing or whatever. You know, you have to play the same sport to be able to to thrash out agreements.
So the thing is, I mean, how do we bring them to the table? How do we, you know, be able to get the hearts and minds of these people? Because in so doing, we'll get the hearts and the minds of our public at the same time.
I always believe that the strategy, the basic underlying strategy, has to be that it's got to cost them something to continue in this way. They have to pay a price. If they don't pay a price, something that they're going to have to, you know, pay up for, and it's they're going to, you know, have difficulties in justifying, they're just going to carry on the way they are.
Well, it's this thing we had back in the military. You grab them by the balls, and the hearts and minds will follow.
So, absolutely.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, the trouble is, you know, we are 16%, 18%, 20%, or whatever, but only a fraction of the whole of Spain, which has a very long tradition of being extremely powerful, misusing its power on a number of occasions, particularly losing its empire. So my feeling is that they will have to be forced to sit down to negotiate. So we have to make life so uncomfortable for Spain, or for European multinationals, for instance, for Spain to be forced, probably by the European Union or by phone calls from Volkswagen to the king, you know, that's the kind of thing.
Or even the Spanish corporations.
Or even the Spanish corporations.
The ANC now has for several months now been with a campaign called Strategic Consumption, Consumo Strategic, where they are recommending turning from the huge suppliers, the big corporations like, well, I won't mention any names.
No, but you, you think about gas, energy, telephone, and energy in general.
Exactly, and shift consumption away towards local suppliers, and in many cases, which is economically favorable for the consumer. These smaller companies that operate in Catalonia would be very happy to take on more clientele. That's one aspect. Another is to give Catalan business a voice, which is what the ANC did with the elections at the Chamber of Commerce, Barcelona Chamber of Commerce, and the candidates that won were clearly pro-independence. They will not do a campaign for independence from the chamber, but they will be representing Catalan interests, because the Barcelona Chamber of Commerce was totally dominated by the big Spanish corporations.
Well, the thing to me, there seems like there should be at least two leverage points. One is that those corporations that have said after 1 October, you know, we're going to move out of Catalonia and set up, you know, legal things, you know, in Madrid or wherever else. We have a boycott that says, okay, you don't believe in Catalonia, we don't believe in you. And we publicize, these are the products of these companies that have said they could care less about Catalonia. You should care less about them. We should also look to see, you know, at, you know, those foreign investors, you know, and the fact that we are getting more foreign investment coming into Catalonia than in the rest of Europe is a powerful statement. Let's see, all right, you know, who is, you know, saying we believe in Catalonia, and let's invest in them. And I think, again, from the leverage point, in that same vein, we know that the Chinese government has invested at least $2 billion in improving the ports and the railway system, you know, in and out of here. And we know that the Russians have a major, major concern about, you know, having a place from which they can ship their goods. Getting these guys involved to start saying, you know, hey, we respect your investment, you know, and, you know, to protect your investment, maybe you ought to talk to these guys in Madrid and put a bug in their ear. So I think, you know, things like this, to me, become, you know, the kind of leverage that we need to do to be able to start building the groundswell of support.
Well, I mean, talking about the port, Hutchinson Whampoa, who are the guys who invested in, I mean, they're major investors and logistics operators. I think the bug's been in their ear for many years now, because you know, the Spanish government just hasn't been coming up with the logistics infrastructures required to get their stuff out of the port of Barcelona. Mainly the railway, the rail, the gauge that will take their containers straight up to France and Germany. Mm-hmm.
It's not meeting its commitments. I mean, these investments were based on Spanish government commitments. If you look at the Spanish budgets in terms of the investment plan for each part of Spain, you'll find that Catalonia is constantly under investing in practice at the end of the year. I mean, even you'll remember 3 or 4 years ago, the promise of Lluvia de Millones that Rajoy was promising, billions of investment over a four-year period. And if you worked it out, that was what was in the budget every year anyway, and they never fulfilled their commitments.
No, and the execution is way below what's budgeted. So, I mean, they claim a budget, but the execution...
That's it. At the end of the year, it's hopeless. Right. We're not just talking about Catalonia, but about the Mediterranean corridor. So Valencia, Murcia would all gain from this European gauge railway.
Well, you're listening to 106.9 FM, Radio Canal Barcelona, English Radio Thursday. We'll be back to talk more with our guest right after this.
Where my culture, I am told, hold no significance. I withered and died in ignorance, but my inner eye can see a race who reigned as king in another place. The green trees were rich and full, beautiful men and women, together as equal. War was gone because all was at peace. But now, like a nightmare, I woke to see I live like a prisoner of poverty, please. Wake me when I am free. I cannot bear captivity, for I would rather be stricken blind live without expression of mind. Ogun kosi yala mo di lati ri pe mo wa bi eleo atushe
was Babatunde Olajunde with Wake Me When I'm Free, you know, which kind of begs the question of our own self-determination. Now, we talked a little bit about public debt and, you know, talked about finances and all of that. You know, we started looking at, the monetary aspects of this. We talked about, the public debt that we have versus the government. Now, Catalonia supposedly, and I say supposedly, owes 52 billion euros to the Spanish government. What is that?
That was part of the FLA, the Fondo de Liquidez Autonómica, which supplies, isn't that?
Liquidity, in terms of liquidity,
yeah.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah.
In other words, it supplies liquidity. It loans money to the autonomy, to Catalonia, at a very, very reasonable interest. In fact, it has reached 0% in some years, okay? Mm-hmm. But in fact, the liquidity they're supplying is because they're not paying their arrears and they're not paying up what they should be paying into the Catalan administration. So what they're doing is they're basically loan sharks loaning us our own money.
Nice. Nice.
And that's part of the public debt that the Catalan government has acquired. I insist. I mean, the public debt is perfectly reasonable.
Right.
So I mean, but the thing is that we're paying interest and the principal on money that is basically ours.
Yeah. It's come from here and is being returned.
For our listeners,
on condition that.
Our listeners, I mean, if they're not aware of how this works, the Spanish government collects the taxes.
Right.
There are one or two very minor taxes, when you sell an apartment or a house or something like that. If it goes above a certain amount, there's a certain small percentage that goes to the Catalan government directly. But in general, VAT,
income tax,
company tax, et cetera, goes to the Spanish government. And then, with negotiation, money gets sent back to the autonomy. I mean, this is how it functions in general, except for the Basque Country and Navarre. Okay. So what's been happening is that the government hasn't been paying up what it is supposed to be paying so that the Catalan administration doesn't have enough money to run the administration. The Spanish are saying that this is because of bad government. It's poor governance. Okay. But so that they very kindly loan us some money at interest, and then the current government says that it's only a caretaker government now, so it can't pay up arrears now. It will have to wait until the new government comes in, which may be after these elections, I'm saying that the soy wants. So, I mean, this is a huge mess. It's a huge mess. It's
totally. You know, talking about messes, and you know, we just talked a little bit about that. You know, we have, you know, in part, you know, apart from, you know, our manufacturing economy, we have a hospitality economy, and tourism is, quote unquote, one of the big revenue generators for Catalonia. But again, is it really? I mean, we have the cruise ships coming in, and I see them, you know, in my neighborhood. They've had their breakfast on board the ship. They're walking around buying trinkets and stuff, and they maybe buy lunch. And then they go back on board the ship to have their dinner. And meanwhile, as we talked about, the ships are polluting in a lot of ways. So, I mean, let's, you know, dissect that a little bit. I mean, let's talk about tourism.
It's a very complex issue because people come from all parts of the world, and depending on where they come from, you find they're spending a great deal more here, if spending money here is what we're talking about, because then you have the other issue of people being forced out of their neighborhood because the price of homes has gone up and they can't afford it. You have a lot of tourism throughout the year from southern France. Amazing, unbelievable, you know, logic. I mean, they get in their car and they come here to spend the weekend, whole year round. You have tourism from Spain, which I think has gone down because so many people have believed that there is a tremendous crisis, political conflict, social conflict, that if you speak Spanish here, you'll be discriminated against. All that kind of thing has brought down tourism. I think the same has happened in the other direction, but that's not what you're talking about right now. And then you have the cruise tourism. I'm not sure how large that is in proportional terms compared to the rest. I imagine they don't spend all that much money, but you know, let's say
it depends.
The French tourists don't spend all that much money when they come here for a weekend, you know.
Right.
Yeah. The cruise issue. It depends on if they're stopping over or if they're kicking off their cruise from Barcelona, because they often arrive at the airport, stay at a hotel for one night until the cruise ship comes in or whatever.
Right.
And then vice versa, the same. They arrive, unload. They may go directly to the airport, but they may spend a night here. So the hotels are fairly near the port, do get high quality tourism in that sense. Okay, so it's not just the stopovers. The stopovers are what you were describing. They're probably the majority, but Barcelona, remember, is one of the major hubs, like Miami, for example.
Right.
So that you do get a lot of people kicking off and ending their cruise here. A lot of Americans come in.
And heck, you know, the airport is just
a
stone's throw from the port itself. So, I mean, that is extremely convenient.
Right.
If you look at Madrid port is rather a long way away from Madrid airport, you know. So in that sense, why do I mention Madrid? Because Barcelona port is basically controlled from Madrid with Madrid sensitivity. There's no pollution in Madrid port. So the pollution issue is just not important as seen from Madrid. And if you look at fuel, I've been looking into this a little bit. The kind and quality of fuel that these ships use varies enormously. And obviously the price of the fuel varies. To the extent that Barcelona port could raise the threshold of the quality of the fuel that these ships use if they want to come into the port, I think that will be noticeable on paper, certainly, and maybe in the quality of the air.
No, and then there's the issue of the plug-and-play ports. In other words, there are ports, Halifax is one, I can't remember what the others were, but where the ships come in, they're obliged to plug into the local grid and switch their engines off. So that they will be consuming local providers, so billing for electricity, without emitting any pollution into the air locally.
Well, I think it's something the airlines have done for years. There are certain airports that become basically the refueling station
from many planes because usually the price is cheaper than a lot of the others, and so they'll be able to get their planes there, refuel them, and stockpile them, and then they'll go on their way. So I don't know if that's something that we want to do as opposed to price as versus quality. I think the whole idea, if we can start selling the idea that we are not necessarily a carbon neutral, but a carbon minimizing place, then that's going to be able to sell it. But at the same time, we start talking about tourism. You know, we look at this whole Airbnb concept. And again, we talk about, the prices of places increasing as a result of tourism. You know, this is another big factor in terms of the quality of life of people here in Barcelona. In New York, we've seen it happen dramatically with not only the Airbnbs, but, the prices of apartments in general going up because they've been bought by people who are not living here, full time. So it's the same kind of thing. We've had a crisis of tourism. We've seen it in Barceloneta, and we see it around Sagrada Familia, where tourist groups, tourist individuals have kind of changed the quality of life for people living here. So where is the balance with all of that?
That's a very tricky issue because, of course, these are the people that are contributing to the economy, even though they are, let's say, heating up the economy at the same time. I'm not answering directly, but indirectly, if you look at many, many countries that have had a long-standing policy of building council homes, which are owned publicly and offered at a reasonable rent rate, that is a whole area which could be expanded enormously in Barcelona, and I think that would bring the pressure off particularly young couples who want to start up a family and sometimes living at home with their parents still or relatives.
Well, we have that in place already.
because they can't afford to access housing. It's a big problem. Having said that, if you compare prices in downtown Paris, London, Milan, Rome, whatever.
It's still much cheaper to live here.
I fear it's still less expensive to live here. Okay.
Yeah, that's the point I wanted to make, which is you're saying that the economy is overheating in the sense of prices going up and there's a lot of dynamism in the economy in Barcelona and in the metropolitan area. But the issue is, of course, it's not just the price of the housing that's going up. It's that the salaries are not going up. So you've got people who are working in the hotels, who are working in the hospitality industry in general. Okay,
in other industries as well.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, but if we're comparing with the tourist industry in particular, all this staff cannot afford to live in Barcelona. They have to live outside Barcelona, and in some cases a long way. So they have to commute every day. And these people start at 6 a.m, 5 a.m, right? So they're coming in at like at 4 or 5 a.m, from outside Barcelona, doing their jobs and then commuting back out. That's not sustainable.
Mm-mm.
It's not sustainable in terms of ecology, okay, in terms of economy.
Right.
Okay, so in that sense, the imbalance is not just in that the prices are increasing, it's that the salaries are relatively falling.
Then
there's another issue, which is Vienna. I was in Vienna recently, and Vienna has been investing in public housing for the last 100 years. They have I think it's about a third of public rental housing is public. It's publicly owned. Okay. So of course, if that third is kept down, in price, reasonably, that means that the private stock is not going to be able to rise all that much. Okay, so maybe you'll have high-end luxury homes, stuff like that, but regular public housing is going to maintain a decent price.
Right.
Can I just add one small issue, and that is if you look at cities the size of Barcelona, 1,700,000, something like that, no other city of that size is so small, it's so dense, it's so compact. because other cities, including the metropolitan area,
right,
aren't double the population. And that is the case of Barcelona for geographic reasons. The sea on one side and mountains, the Tibidabo mountains on the other. And on both sides you have L'Hospitalet, Badalona, which, right, unless you know, you might think they're just districts of Barcelona itself. Once you get...
Well, they are.
Well,
true.
Don't tell the mayors, you know. But I know a few years ago, a lot of locals thought they were some Barcelonese. Right. So when people commute, let's say, we're talking about probably smaller distances, to be strict, you know, to live in another city. In London, we're talking about vast distances,
right, right,
and Barcelona, or we're talking about smaller distances.
But it's definitely going that way. I mean, just look at the traffic jams on the motorways into Barcelona.
Right.
So all these are people who are living in the metropolitan area and driving
absolutely
in, which is exactly what happens in London.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So you've got people who
then New York
kicked out of the center of downtown Barcelona, which is the whole of the city. Okay, and they live outside in towns outside, which in practice are the suburbs of Barcelona.
Yeah.
Well, we've had a great conversation today, guys. I'm glad we could do it. And we've had some good times over the years here talking about a lot of things. And this is an issue that we won't see the end of anytime soon, but hopefully it will have, you know, some positive benefits. And we'll have you come back as, you know, things progress judiciously and politically, and see where we are. But we're going to leave you today with a song that kind of sums it up from Donny Hathaway called Someday We'll All Be Free. Have a great one, Barcelona. Talk to you next week.
Keep your stride. Never mind.